Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast on the Big Lead. I'm Ryan Glasspiegel. We're joined by Joe Davis this week. Joe calls Dodger games on Spectrum Sportsnet LA and also calls college football games on Fox Sports. Been kind of a busy couple months for you, huh?
It sure has. Yeah, the overlap here with football and baseball, it makes for a pretty hectic run. But you got to remind yourself that you're really lucky to do this. And even though it is busy, and I think my family's ready to have me back home a little more, I wouldn't trade it for anything. It's what I've always dreamt of doing.
So the World Series begin tonight on Fox, and I'm wondering, what do you see the biggest stories between the Astros and the Dodgers headed into it?
I think that it's easy to point to Clayton Kershaw and his postseason legacy. And a lot of people have pointed out the fact that he's not been bad in the postseason. He's just not been the guy that he is in the regular season, in the postseason. And here's his first opportunity to pitch on the very biggest stage that the postseason has and try to put some of those narratives to rest and kind of redefine his legacy. And, we're so lucky doing all the games that we get to watch him every fifth day. And it's my favorite thing in doing Dodger games, just getting to watch him pitch. So, for me, it's just the chance to watch maybe the greatest pitcher of our, definitely the greatest pitcher of our generation, one of the greatest pitchers of all time, the chance to finally watch him on the sport's biggest stage.
Yeah. And so it's kind of weird because if he had lost that game against the Cubs, game five, people would have been like, oh, he's not a big game pitcher, but he wins. And then it's like, oh, there's not that big of stakes to it. Don't you think there's a little bit of a double standard there?
Totally. It's a great point. It's like it's only filed under big game if he loses at this point. And I understand that's how it works. Part of that is he's kind of created that story by having some not really even bad games, but bad single innings that have marred postseason outings. And anything, how it goes, anything that can feed into the story that we've developed and that we think fits, we're going to try and kind of mold what happens to it. And you're right. If he starts well, then you kind of forget about it and you don't file it under the postseason starts. You file it under, well, he's Clayton Kershaw. Of course he shut the Cubs down and they haven't been very good in the postseason. But if he loses, you're right. Then it feeds the narrative that Kershaw can't pitch in October.
So as you know, the Dodgers got off to just an unbelievably torrid start. They were 91-36 in late August, and then they went on a 1-16 skid where everybody was wondering, okay, have they somehow lost their magic? At any point during that run, were you starting to be a little bit concerned that they might not be able to recapture the play that they had previously?
Yeah, truthfully, I think because it wasn't like there was one thing that was going wrong. It was everything. I was kind of taking turns. Different nights, it'd be different things. Because that was the case and you couldn't pinpoint one thing, the longer it went, the more disturbing and concerning it got. I didn't think that's who they were, but my concern became, can they, as you put it, recapture what they had been doing? Could they become again the team that we saw for much of the summer? And you kind of started to see it over the final week and a half or so. They finished winning 8 of 10, but man, when they were in that losing 16-17 stretch, that was as amazing as the 53-10 or whatever it was, as amazing as that was to watch. Watching them lose 16-17 was even more amazing just because it came on the heels of that incredible run. And even the worst teams don't lose 16-17. So, yeah, it did reach a point where there was definite concern. But as they've proven, you know, October is a different beast, and seemingly they flipped the switch back to where they were in the middle part of the year.
It's not like you can just make a blanket statement for 25 players, a manager, and however many people there are on the coaching staff. But during that losing skid, what was your sense of the team's temperament?
Dave Roberts does such a good job of not changing, always being a guy that's smiling, always being upbeat. And the old cliche that teams take on the personality of their coaches and their managers in this case was true. I mean, of course, you're going to have some frustrated players and some nights where Dave is a little more frustrated than talking with the media. When you lose 11 in a row, that's natural. But they almost, to the point where you know, bordered on the definition of insanity, were steadfast that they'd be fine. You know, and I think the fans are sitting there, and even us as broadcasters quietly off the air thinking, guys, what do you mean you're going to be fine? You've lost 11 in a row now. You've lost 16 of 17. But to Dave Roberts' credit, they never change. You know, they continue to go about it the same way they did when they were winning every night, which was last night doesn't matter. The only game we worry about is today. And I think the fact that they had established that standard earlier in the year when things were going well probably helped them weather the storm through that stretch.
You mentioned Dave Roberts. Like, the Dodgers, they've got a ton of position players, like almost too many for the amount of spots they have. How do you think that he's going to, like, juggle that in the series against the Astros?
Yeah, and you add Corey Seager into it, right? From the championship series where he wasn't on the active roster, sounds like he's going to be active. I think the first thing is it's going to be interesting to see whose spot he takes. Will it be Curtis Granderson, who at this point is not doing anything? He's not even starting against right-handed pitching anymore. And, you know, I don't necessarily see him on the roster because you have Andre Ethier, who is pretty much making those starts. I don't think it'll be Charlie Culberson, who is the spot that, you know, the guy that directly took his roster spot because he was really good in the championship series. And even if Corey Seager is active, who knows if he's 100%, and you'd hate to be left without that added level of insurance, you know, with a guy like Culberson on the roster. But man, he's done it all year. I mean, the calling card for the team has been depth, and Dave Roberts has managed it beautifully. So yeah, they've turned it into something that could maybe be a little bit cumbersome. How do you get all these guys playing time? How do you work all these pieces into very clearly the main strength of this organization?
From the outside, it seems like Yasiel Puig has matured a lot this year. Is that the sense you got as well?
Yeah, for sure. We've always seen flashes of his ability. You've seen stretches where he's looked like he's maybe turned it around maturity-wise. But never before have you seen this long of a consistent stretch where he's doing the things that he's doing. I mean, I saw something the other day where pitches per plate appearance in the postseason, he's fifth of 150 hitters or something like that. Yasiel Puig has seen the fifth most pitches per plate appearance. You know, the free-swinging wild horse is taking pitches and drawing walks. And that's been the case for much of the year. And I think that's a reflection of how he's matured and how he's making every day important. And, you know, his relationship with Dave Roberts has been key. His relationship with Turner Ward, the hitting coach, has been key in developing a more consistent approach at the plate. So for sure, I think he's matured off the field, and I think it's reflected in what he's doing on the field.
Switching to college football, you called Wisconsin, Maryland this past Saturday. I thought you did a really good job. I went to Wisconsin. I'm wondering, do you think that this is a team that can compete with better competition when that arises on their schedule?
Yeah, you know, I'm not completely sold on them yet. I really like the defense. I really like Jonathan Taylor. But I don't see the consistency in the offense yet. And that's not to say they can't get there. You know, as the receivers get a little bit healthier, and Corey Brooks still a young player, so as he logs a few more starts, that he can't turn into that. But I just don't see the the firepower offensively, and excuse me for my one-year-old sheep, apparently doesn't like Wisconsin that much either. I don't quite see it yet. The good thing for them, though, is that they're not really going to have to on this regular season schedule. You know, the Big Ten championship game and a potential playoff game, sure, but, man, it's an easy schedule, and that doesn't change much moving forward.
Yeah, Michigan will be an interesting test. Michigan is clearly underwhelmed on expectations, but I don't know, anytime you're facing a team with Jim Harbaugh, I think it's a little bit of a concern.
Sure. Yeah, you never know. You never know how the – and I still think it's a really talented Michigan team, especially defensively. I think Michigan has the kind of defense that could shut Wisconsin's offense down. And, you know, that could be a – that could be a 6-3 game, because it's not like Michigan's outscoring many people.
No, with Hornibrook, you mentioned him. He makes some great throws, but then he just, like, one or two passes a game are just like these interceptions that you're like, what was he thinking?
Yeah, and I guess that's probably the product of he's still new. I mean, I know that he's in his second year as a starter, but he's still, what, you know, only a year and a half of starting under his belt. I think you're getting close to the point where you can't use that excuse for him anymore. But, you know, and he's still throwing those interceptions at the end of this year and in the next year, then yeah, maybe you can get legitimately frustrated with it and the lack of growth. But I think it's still part of the growth of a quarterback, where every now and then those are going to pop up, with the exception of the, you know, the real elite special guys that only come about every now and then.
How does preparing for college football differ from preparing for a Major League Baseball telecast? And then, like, what is similar about them?
I guess the big difference is, am I doing a game nationally, or am I doing it for the Dodgers? You know, and preparing for a Major League Baseball game that's a Dodger game, because I'm around it every day, just simply being around it every day is kind of the preparation for it. And having done the night, the game before, you know, that's kind of your preparation, and reading the articles on that. But when you're coming in for either a football game nationally, or doing a, you know, Fox Major League Baseball game where I'm the neutral guy, you spend all week reading articles, you spend all week trying to learn the teams to the point where you can teach the diehard fans something. You know, people watch these teams as if it's their job in some cases, and you have to come in on 5 and 6 days of preparation and act like you know more than the people that treat their fandom like a job. So in that way, it's similar. Where it's different is there's a lot of memorization that goes on for getting ready for a football game. I think the number one key for prepping football is to have the names and numbers memorized, like I have the name of my daughter memorized, because if you're slow on identifying, it's going to mess up your entire call. You have no chance to be smooth, no chance to have a clean delivery. If you have to think, you know, that number 23 is Jonathan Taylor, if you have to look down to find that, you have all that information in front of you. But if you have to spend the time to look down to find it, I think that you know, you're not going to be as good as you can be. Baseball, on the other hand, you don't have that, because they come up in the same order and they don't move from fixed positions defensively. So I think that's probably the biggest difference in where the focus is throughout the week for me.
You played quarterback in college at Beloit College in Wisconsin. Do you think that gives you a little bit of an edge in preparing to call football games, since you have a kind of some of an awareness of the mechanics of football?
Yeah, I think so. I think it helps in the preparation. I think it helps in when we meet with the coaches. And then I think it probably helps too, just calling the game. Hard to say how that manifests itself when I'm calling the game, but hopefully it allows me to, you know, take my analyst a step further and allows me to see some things in my call where I can anticipate a little bit better. I think anticipation is a key for play-by-play guys. So, you know, it hopefully helps me in that regard. I also, though, have to be careful not to try and show it, like not to make an effort to show that I know football. I think earlier in my career, that maybe would have been a fault of mine, where I tried to prove that I played the game by being a little extra fancy in my play-by-play and maybe doing some of the analyst job when I finished calling the play. So So, you know, learning to be careful, not necessarily hide the fact that I know this stuff, but just utilize that a little bit better. I think I've done better as I've gone throughout my career.
For people who are just learning of you now, you're 29 years old, you turned 30 in December. Can you walk people through how you got from calling the Schaumburg Flyers baseball team in the Northern League to now doing the Dodgers telecast where you replace Vin Scully, as well as doing college football games on Fox?
So after the Schaumburg job, which was the summer before my senior year of college, it was an unpaid internship, but I did all the games. So I built the tape from that, and the tape that I built from that got me a job in Montgomery, Alabama. And it doesn't seem like much, but at the point, it may be the youngest AA announcer in the country. And I had to step out of English class to take the call from the GM that I had gotten the job. And so that kind of stepped me ahead of the curve that, you know, getting that job and having an organization to take a chance on me at an early age like that. Did 3 years in Montgomery with the Montgomery Biscuits, classic name. We had mascot was a biscuit with eyes and a slab of butter for a tongue. So that's when I knew I had made it, when I had a mascot with a slab of butter for a tongue. Did the 3 years there, went to ESPN for a couple of years, some overlap in that. I signed with ESPN early on in my third season in Montgomery. I was doing mostly ESPNU stuff, college football, college basketball, a little bit of Major League Baseball on ESPN radio towards the end of my time there, and went from ESPN to Fox. And I think that probably the exposure that I got making that move, where I was doing some big time college football and then finally doing consistent Major League Baseball, that's probably what helped open the door and put me on the Dodgers radar as they started to think about what their plan was once Vin Scully retired.
Were there any, when you were calling the Montgomery Biscuits games, were there any like minor league players either on that team or on opponents where you just saw them and you knew they were destined to be stars and then got proven right?
Yeah, we had quite a few guys in Montgomery. At one point in our rotation, we had Matt Moore, Chris Archer, and Alex Cobb at the same time. So we had some really good pitchers. Jake McGee, who's a reliever for the Rockies now. One of my favorites is Stephen Vogt, who became kind of a cult hero in Oakland and traded to Milwaukee midway through the summer. But he was in Montgomery with us. Tim Beckham finally breaking in with the Rays and now the Orioles. And then against us, Giancarlo Stanton hit a ball over our scoreboard, which was on top of a huge wall. And it was a huge scoreboard by minor league standards, but he homered over the scoreboard and they got called up to the majors the next day. So you knew that he was headed somewhere. Paul Goldschmidt similarly was in Arizona, and yeah, he was a similar type player that just kind of stood out. So that's been cool. It's been one of the gratifying things is to see some of those guys that I covered in the minors. And now for some of them do their games in the majors. It's a pretty special thing.
Is there anyone in the industry who's, or like maybe more than one, who's been like a really good mentor for you?
Yeah, and it's hard to even do this because there have been so many that have taken time to help me.
Oh, man.
You always leave somebody out when you do this. But early on, Len Casper, a Chicago Cubs TV announcer, he was one of the very first guys and has continued to be a great mentor to me. Brian Anderson, the Brewers TV voice, and you know, does all kinds of great stuff with Turner now. Corey Provis, who's the Minnesota Twins radio announcer. Mike Tirico has been great to me. Joe Buck has been great to me. I'm just so lucky that there have been so many guys who, early on in my career, I was probably a huge pest, a huge nuisance to these guys. You know, always sending emails and making calls. And another one is Joe Block in Pittsburgh. Always trying to bang these guys' doors down to get whatever information I could about the industry and learn all I could. And I'm sure I was annoying as heck, but they were kind enough to, when they didn't have to, help me and continue to this day help me, and are guys that I lean on for advice. And, you know, anytime that I have a college kid or an aspiring broadcaster reach out and ask for my help, I immediately think of the help that I got from those guys and how much it meant to me anytime they'd reply to an email, how patient they were with me, and try to pass that on.
Let's say live rights are all up for grabs and some of them might come into a territory where you could conceivably call these games. What is the Mount Rushmore of events that you would love to one day call in your career?
I think if I could narrow it down to one event, it'd be a Game 7 of a World Series. Obviously, World Series would be spectacular, but if I could really nitpick, I would say a seventh game of a World Series, I think, for me, would be the ultimate.
What about the other three? I said Mount Rushmore, so there's four.
I am more of a college football guy than I am an NFL guy. So it's kind of a toss-up for me between doing the Super Bowl and doing the College Football National Championship. I think that I would probably have to put Super Bowl second because it's a Super Bowl. College Football National Championship third. March Madness would be incredible to one day call. So we'll put that on there too without putting a ton of thought into it.
Searing college football finals, Super Bowl, and March Madness. Is there anything that we didn't discuss either about your career path or the Dodgers or your thoughts on college football that you think is really important and you want to get off your chest right now?
Not that I can think of. I think we covered it.
All right, cool. Thank you a lot for coming on. We really appreciate your time. This is Joe Davis. He calls games for the Dodgers and college football for Fox Sports, and my guess is we're all going to be seeing and hearing a lot of him in the years to come. Thanks again, Joe.
Thank you, Ryan. It's great to talk to you.
Such turned strange.